Luke 22, starting in verse 39. Jesus went out as usual, which is important because that's why Judas knew where Jesus was at. You know, where else are you going to find him in a sea of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people in the surroundings area? Judas knew exactly where he was at because Jesus was going to the same place each night. So he went out as usual to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. On reaching the place, he said to them, "Pray that you will not fall into temptation." He withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down, and prayed. It's tough to find out if there's a double entendre going here with that stone's throw. It literally says the throwing of a stone. It's the only time it's ever recorded in the New Testament as this colloquialism that we even still use today. I mean, not many people say, "Yeah, I was just a stone's throw away." We would usually just say, he's like right over there. But it actually says that, which would conjure up in a Jewish mind anytime thrones are being stoned. Wait, stones are being thrown. We would often think of a death sentence. So we don't know if Luke is giving this double entendre with this stone's throw away. Whether he is or not, it's up for debate. But it is interesting that he says that that's how far they're away. Verse 42, "Father, if you're willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done." The other gospel writers record that this prayer happened three times, that this was an ongoing thing. I shouldn't say that. Sometimes I fail to truly grasp the importance of Jesus' prayer. The Son of God, the Son of Man, God in the flesh, and he is begging God for another way out. Think on that a moment. That's how just absolutely horrific this whole scenario is. That God in the flesh is begging for any other way than through the cross. "Lord, if there's another way, show it to me now." That's just how much pressure is on Jesus Christ. And if you notice something, God does not come down and say, "Yeah, no problem, there's lots of ways to meet. I can create lots of paths. I'm going to have lots of other religious leaders come after you, Jesus, and they will claim that they also have a way to God as well, and they're going to be correct, so you know what, you don't have to die on the cross. You can't get around it. I don't care how you try and dance. You cannot miss the fact that there is only one way to God. There's only one way that man was saved." Because that's what Jesus was praying. Jesus was praying to God, "Look, Lord, Father, if there's another way, show it to me, we'll do that." But there was no other way. There's only one way. And that was through Jesus Christ and the cross. You can't escape it. You can't miss it. You can't move around it. Otherwise, Jesus prayed in vain. And I don't think we believe that. So he is begging. Luke is the only one that adds these next two verses, which tell us that an angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. Angels are quite mysterious in the Bible because we don't know a whole lot about them. There's not a whole lot of angelology that you can grasp from it. We do get a couple of things. One, this is going to draw to mind for a reader, Luke chapter 4, when Jesus was being tempted in the wilderness. And then after that temptation, angels came and ministered to him. At a time when he was absolutely down and depressed, when he was at the breaking point, when he had no longer any energy to function, which is what is happening at this case, he is in a whole heap of trouble. And he has no other strength and no other energy left. An angel comes and ministers to him. Now, I don't know how an angel ministers to people, but that's what Hebrews says, is that angels are ministering spirits. Some of them are fighters like Michael, some of them are announcers like Gabriel, but apparently the most of them are there to strengthen and encourage. Now, I don't know. I know a lot of people, and I know I have had it myself. When you have been strengthened and encouraged, when you are at a point of almost sheer breakage, and yet somehow or other you don't slip over the edge, that's ministering spirits to you. I get a lot of encouragement from that because I think we all need that from time to time. And Jesus is praying, and again, like we said, this happens three times. Luke just kind of condenses it. But he adds in this interesting phrase, and being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. And then every pastor has to go into this weird thing that if you are under so much pressure and under so much anguish that you could actually break the blood vessels in your face and in your head, and that when you sweat, your sweat is actually mingled with blood. And then they talk about that's how much pressure Jesus was under. And the problem is that's not what the text says, does it? It says that he was sweating and it was dropping to the ground like drops of blood. And I think we've all been in those situations, granted whether it might just be we're hot or exercising and the sweat is pouring down. But that's what, this is the type of thing that Jesus is undergoing. He is praying so fervently. And I will admit, I have not prayed that fervently. I have not prayed so fervently that I had sweated that profusely. I'm not doubting you can't. I just haven't. It reminds me of the importance of prayer. Reminds me of the value of prayer. And look what it says here. Oh, I got another point to make. Verse 45. This is the time when we're supposed to slap the disciples around, right? Because what are the disciples doing while Jesus is praying? Sleeping. Bunch of backslidden, nasty disciples. So horrible. They're cowards. They're chickens. And of course, every pastor's like, oh yeah, you know, and after a big giant meal like Passover and it's late at night, and they're kind of sleepy. I don't buy it for a second because Luke says it perfectly. Why are they sleeping? Exhausted from sorrow. Now, maybe you felt that before. I have. Have you ever been so overfilled with grief to the point where you can't even keep your eyes open? I don't think the disciples were like, oh, this is a good place to nap, and they lay their heads down and, Peter, do you have your blankie poo with you? Yeah. Come over here, I'll rest my... You know, in some ways, I kind of like that they're exhausted from sorrow. You know why? They finally get it. You know, all up until then, Jesus is like, you know what? I'm going to go and die. And they're like, yeah, Jesus, yeah, we got to die to self, right? He's speaking metaphorically, right? You know, what do you mean you die? Hand it over to the chief priest and you'll be, what? You're speaking metaphorically, right, Jesus? Yeah. They had no clue. So often it says that it was hidden from their eyes. They did not grasp the concept that he was going to die. But somehow, during the Passover meal and the subsequent talks, they got it. He's going to be dead. And that's going to be quite sorrowful. I never, ever doubt how sorrowful it is when someone loses a loved one, but how hard it is to lose someone suddenly when you know it's going to happen. That's why they're exhausted. Now, Jesus does chide them to the point that you do get the idea that even in our sorrow, I mean, we just sang it, didn't we? In the road marked with suffering, and though there's pain in the offering, what should we be doing? We should still be saying, blessed be the name of the Lord. There is still something to be said about that, that even in the midst of that, and I've been there. I've been in times when I'm so overwhelmed with grief that sometimes my prayers are pretty weak, but they still need to be prayed. It's still something that comes out. It's still supposed to be a part of it. But they're so exhausted. And Jesus says, why are you sleeping? He asked them, get up and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. Isn't that just a great little formula? I don't think there's many formulas in the Bible, but that's a good one right there, if I could choose one. How do you not be tempted? Pray. It's a good thing. I always joke with people that way. You know, if you're about to do something bad, just start talking to God. All of a sudden, it's gone. Because you can't, like, be talking to God and being ready to do something bad. You know, it just doesn't work. But that's what we need, is more prayer so that we don't fall into temptation. Again, John goes into a much longer detail. I'm going to leave it at that because we're going to get to this time when he's arrested. Verse 42, while he was still speaking, a crowd came up, and the man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus asked him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? you can't, when you study Jesus' reaction to Judas, you cannot come away except by thinking, what a good and gracious, loving, forgiving, merciful God we serve. Because if it was me, and Judas comes walking up, I don't think the gospel writer's going to write down what I would have said. You little snake in the grass, yeah, I'm going to squash you. I might have just looked at him and touched him, or like when he comes up to kiss, once he kisses, he just falls to a pile of ash. Wouldn't that be cool? Because that's what I would do if I was God. But over and over, even Jesus says to Judas, he even calls him at one point friend. Not like, friend, but genuine friend. He's constantly offering to Judas another chance. Judas never takes it. It's amazing. Verse 49. Okay, so we got the bleary-eyed disciples who are exhausted from sorrow. Okay, maybe they are a little full from Passover. It's late at night. Jesus is praying. And all of a sudden, this crowd shows up. Now, if you were the disciples, all of a sudden you realize, I'm in trouble. So, and this crowd that shows up, John calls it a cohort. Could be anywhere from like 200 to 600 soldiers. 200 to 600 people show up for this little band of 12. Isn't this great? They are vastly outnumbered. Also, are these soldiers, are they skilled? Are they masters of their weapons? Do they know how to handle a sword? Exactly. So, Peter, you got to love Peter. Luke doesn't call him out, but it's Peter because the other gospel writers say this. When Jesus' followers saw what was going to happen, they said, Lord, should we strike with our swords? And one of them struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. Now, a couple things has got to be said here. First of all, when Jesus asked this question of Jesus, was he really asking this question to get a response and then to follow that response? No, because what does Jesus eventually say to him? Peter, you idiot, put that away. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. We have all those little things, right? That's from this section. This is how I think it happened, because the other gospel writers talk about this word suddenly. It's literally these people show up and Peter's like, what's going on? Ah, Lord, should we strike with our swords? And he picks up his sword. He starts going after it. That's how fast this thing took place. I don't know how many times I've prayed prayers like that. I've done it, I don't know how many times. Dear Lord, should I do this? And I'm not actually looking for a response. I want God to somehow bless what I am about to do. That's dangerous. But I think it happens way too much. Lord, should we move? Oh, yeah, let's move. I mean, is there prayer? Lord, should I marry this person? I really don't answer that question because I already have it in my mind that I'm going to marry him. Lord, should I take this job? No, I'm really not asking you, God, because you might say no, but I really want the job. So I'm going to already say, we already have our minds made up. As opposed to if Peter were to go, Lord, should we attack with our swords? Pause. Jesus would have said, no, right? I mean, quite simple, no. Be careful of prayers you pray where you already have your mind made up what you're going to do, but you want God to bless it. At that point, why even bother? Just go and do your own thing and God will correct you later anyway. Don't sanctify it or sanctimoniously bless it with a prayer. That's not good. If you really seek God, you have to ask and then you have to listen. Because what happens if God comes back with an answer you didn't want? You've got to be ready for it. Now, Luke picks up this sword. I don't know we know a little bit about the sword. It's a little bit, it's not exactly, best I got, is like this machete. It was a... feel like Luke Skywalker. It's a little bit like this. It was a short sword. John talks about it as a short sword. So it's maybe a foot to 18 inches, almost like this machete. So we're not talking, it wasn't a sword that you were supposed to be like a sword fighter with. It was a short sword designed for one thing and one thing only. splitting skulls. Yeah. This isn't like, because if I have something like a machete, I might try, I mean, if I were going to attack, stand up, I'm going to attack. No, I'm just kidding. I would probably do one of these like swinging things and try and like maybe slice, like cut open a belly or, you know, something like that. Or if it was, you know, a pointed sword, I might do one of the whole lunge thingies, right? This is a skull splitter. It's not designed for slicing. It's designed for breaking large items. That's why a machete doesn't really work that well. If this was a whole lot thicker, that would be it. This is why people sometimes can't figure out, well, what is Peter doing? Well, first of all, is Peter a swordsman? No, he's a fisherman. He has no idea, like me. I start wielding this thing, this could get dangerous, okay? That means, yeah, we've already seen that. Yeah, I'm already knocking things over here. Holy cow. So how do you slice off an ear of somebody? You miss. Now, I can only think of it in one of two ways. One, if he comes and chops up. But that doesn't make any sense because that would be, that's an awkward motion. It really doesn't quite work. And how do you get an ear then? I mean, you have to come up and then kind of angle it a little. You know, it just doesn't work. And especially since it's not designed for slicing, it's designed to split a skull. So if I was going to split your skull, what would I do? Two hands, come straight down. And what is, bonus points if you can name the high priest's servant. No? See if it's Peter. No, Caiaphas, the high priest. What did you say, Cranky? You can't remember it? What was that, Jim? Malchus! Malchus, the servant of the high priest. We only know that from John. It's just bonus points. You're not going to get an extra crown in heaven. Okay, so if I'm coming straight down, what is Malchus going to do? Yeah, like, whoa, what's going on? And that's why, as it comes down, chops the ear, probably hits the shoulder. I don't know if it slices a shoulder, but it was enough to take the ear off. It was enough to sever that. Jeez. I'll say it for the tape. I thought that was good. He was trying to hit Malchus in the middle. Yeah, that's just horrible. Jeez. Josh left. He's going to be confused on what songs to sing next. He's going to be like, what do I do? He's coming back in. Quick, set it all back up. There we go. Hey, Josh, how you doing? All right. Had a sword problem here. All right. Now, another thing. Why is he going after Malchus? I think it might be the closest, but there's also another thing. Okay, you're Peter, the fisherman. You got a sword. You're going to wield it. You look quickly around. I'm going to find the smallest dude around, okay? The big, burly guy, big, burly guy, big, burly guy. Oh, you I can take, yes. Yeah, you know, that's how it. I think that's what's going to happen, because otherwise, if you're a soldier and some dude comes with a skull splitter, you would just totally take him out. It would be done. It would be over with. So Peter is going after, and of course, who knows what's going through Peter's mind, because he really doesn't think that often. But I think we always seem to do the same exact thing. So he goes, and he cuts off this dude's ear. Verse 51, but Jesus answered no more of this, and he touched the man's ear and healed him. Why? Because he's Jesus. Yeah. I think there's two reasons why. One, if you are a soldier and you just witnessed this attack, and if the news gets back to the high priest, what's going to be the sentence laid upon Peter? Good. Exactly. Death or Jesus? That's the answer. Good. Death. Peter's going to die. Now, what would you do? Because Peter attacks, and again, if I was Mr. Swordsman soldier dude, and this guy starts wheeling, I would probably by now have my sword drawn and ready to kill. Jesus somehow stops the thing, reaches down, picks up the ear, and puts it back on. Now, what would you do if you're a big dumb soldier? Is there a crime here? No blood, no... I guess everything's fine. There's no problem here. He probably saved Peter's life. Because if that did go back, first of all, I think Peter would have been executed on the spot, or B, he would die later. Also, I think it's a really good example because this, I think, is important too. Jesus seems to be in the business of healing people that are bloodied up by Christians. I've seen it happen in, I don't know why Searchlight seems to be a magnet for it, but we are, of people who have gone to other places and have walked away going, man, I just got destroyed. I just got bloodied up. Is there a place I can go where I can get healed? Because, you know, again, I'm getting older, and I think I'm getting wiser. But I was really good at that, of slicing and dicing, and I think Jesus was walking behind me going, sorry about that. Sorry. Yeah, let me heal you there. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, Mark, I'll deal with him later. Yeah, sorry about that. And he goes on and he heals. So this is why I need to make sure and tell people that if you have been hurt by the church, I can guarantee you have not been hurt by Jesus. Sometimes Jesus' followers make some very terrible mistakes and end up really seriously hurting people. And I know it's hard to hear it from a pastor because I'm part of the system, so to speak. So I just have to apologize to all of you on behalf of every pastor and church out there. That if a church has come and really hurt you, then I am truly and utterly sorry that it happened. And I pray that God will come and by his love demonstrate his kindness towards you and heal you of any wound that you have. Some of them are big, and some of them are ugly. Some of them are small nicks and scrapes and bruises. Please understand that the church, pastors, are just people, just like the rest of mankind, and we make mistakes. I pray that you feel the love of God in your life. It's also interesting that this is the last known recorded miracle of Jesus. The last known miracle that we have, save resurrection, and walking through walls, but I don't know if that counts as a miracle or just something really cool, is him, this healing miracle of healing Malchus. So Malchus gets healed, and, okay, let me finish this up, verse 52. Then Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, and the soldiers who had come for him. So, I mean, this is a significant group of people. Am I leading a rebellion that you have come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me. But this is your hour when darkness reigns. I'm starting to figure out. I'm starting to figure out how Jesus operates when he speaks things like this. Especially through his trials and through his death and resurrection, you find out that sometimes Jesus talks and then sometimes Jesus doesn't talk. And you think to yourself, why? Because essentially what Jesus is doing is he's giving a really good dig here. He's saying, look, you could have arrested me at any time in the temple. You didn't have to come out here. You don't have to send people in the middle of the night to come here and arrest. You could have done this in the middle of the daytime, and you knew exactly where I was at. You didn't have to come for me this way. And I don't know why, but it's pure speculation. But I have to believe when Jesus says things like this, it's for somebody. And I just have to wonder if someone in that group that was coming, because you all of a sudden, you're sitting there in your barracks and it's been a busy Passover and, oh, praise God, Passover is done. We can finally squelch some of these things and people are going to be leaving. When all of a sudden you get woken up in the middle of the night, we got to go arrest somebody. You're like, who? Well, this guy named Jesus, he's been teaching in the temple. And I wonder if one of those guys said to themselves, why are we doing it? Jesus, the guy that, we see him every day. Why don't we just, why? This is highly irregular. This is strange. wonder what this guy has been saying. I don't know. I don't know why I think that, but I think that Jesus is speaking this for somebody. Because that's how Jesus seems to operate. I haven't fully settled the question in my mind about this whole sword-wielding thing, because if I was preaching on Ephesians chapter 6, what would I be telling you? Yeah, I'd be talking to you about the sword of the Spirit and the Word of God. And why aren't you wielding your sword? And why aren't you out there on the offense? And why aren't you doing stuff? And why aren't you sharing? And yet here we got Jesus saying, put away your swords. When do we attack? When do we defend? When do we lay down our swords? When do we pick up our swords? And the Bible even says it in two different places, which makes it a little confusing. You beat your pruning shears into swords. Why? Because you need swords. And the other times you're going to beat your swords. Yeah, plowshares and pruning shears. Well, which one is it? What, should we attack or should we not? Should we pick up our sword or should we not? And I think this is where wisdom comes in. And I think this is where motivation comes in. I'm getting this more and more. I'm starting to finally figure this out a little bit more. Because before I was quite baffled as, when do we pick it up and when do we lay it down? And then more importantly, how do we wield it? I'll give you an example. I was at this convention, and so it's this highly political thing. I told you all about it. It was really interesting. So I had to get up because I needed a cookie. I needed some sugar, and they had some cookies available. And the bad part was, it was a guy just got up to start a Bible study. So it's not really good of me. I'm sorry, but I think God made me do it. I got up, and I went and I grabbed a cookie. And I'm coming back, and as I'm about to enter back into the room, this young kid, 20-something years old, comes marching out, and he is in a huff. He looks over at me, and he goes, man, I hate this Bible study. This Bible study is stupid. I don't know why we're doing it. And I'm like, well, what's wrong with the Bible? Oh, it's all about what we should do for God, how we should live for Jesus, how our lives should reflect what God has done. This is just stupid. Why are we talking about what Jesus has done for me? And, you know, he's one of those that, let's just talk about the cross all the live long day. Don't talk about what it means to be a Christian. And that's what he believes. And it's so funny because I know what he's thinking. Oh, you're one of me, right? Because you're out here eating a cookie. So you believe just the same way I do. And he starts railing. He's saying, you know what? This whole thing is being taken over by these people with these worship services, with drums and guitars. And it's so funny. I'm standing there like, of all the people you chose to talk to, you're talking to the one that's probably on the farthest extreme of the matter. I know there's some others that do it, but I don't think anyone does it quite as extreme as we do. And so I'm kind of sitting there laughing because at first I really wanted to whip out my sword. I want to whip it out and just carve this little dude up because I could. I know I could. Dude, I'm going to quote so many scripture passages to you. You're going to be laying there bloody on the ground, and I will make you submit to me, and then God's going to come and smite you, and I'm going to win. And I'm thinking to myself, I can do this. I can take this punk kid. And then I realize, because then I'm sure Jesus is coming. Sorry about that. I'm going to put you all back together here. Because I decided to do something I've never done, which is, I listened to him. Well, what was that, Jackie? Offer him. Okay, here's a cookie. It was really interesting because I don't think much got accomplished at this district convention. But I think just maybe I moved someone along the track. Obviously not me because, you know, why did I go get a cookie right at that one time when this kid comes out? Because we got into these interesting discussions about, is the medium the message? You know, is contemporary worship evil? Is all contemporary worship schmaltzy, non-biblical? Here's a couple of cute stories and one little point. I mean, why can't we just have some pure biblical teaching? And of course, I'm just standing there smiling. I'm like, yeah, you know, I think we do need a movement back too. And of course, this guy thinks I'm with him the whole time until I finally say, yeah, you know what? I'm one of those guys, though, that has the drums and the guitar and the band in there. And the look on his face was pure and utter shock. But I got a chance to talk to him. Because I used wisdom instead of just whipping out the sword like Peter and doing it. But also, I could have, if I wanted to, never even drawn the sword. And would that have been a mistake? I think at that point, I would just be a complicit agreeer with this gentleman. I had to say something. But how do I say it? When do I say it? And what tone should I have? That's where wisdom comes in. So you might be asking yourself, when do I attack? When do I lay down? When do I listen? When do I speak? I think that's only through wisdom and through motivation. Because at first I was very angry. And then I looked at this kid and I'm like, wow, you know what? God loves this kid. He died for him. And I know he has so much zeal for the Lord. If only it takes some time and instead of just taking what's spoon-fed him and actually think, I think that this guy could be a great and wonderful asset for God. Think about that in your own life. When do you speak? When do you not speak? When you pray, do you actually pray to get an answer? Do you pray so that God will bless you? These are good questions. All right, I'm moving on. Peter disowns Jesus. There's so many cool little factoids that will have nothing to do with your salvation or your spiritual life, but I'm going to give them to you anyway because I think they're cool. Then seizing him, they led him away and took him into the house of the high priest. Of course, all the disciples scatter. Don't yell at the disciples. I think the disciples were told to scatter. My personal opinion, can't prove it, but I think I got some good evidence. Because John records that when Jesus was about to be arrested, he looks at them and says, well, look, you all are looking for me, right? Jesus of Nazareth? Yeah, that's me right here. Let these guys go. And John even records, to fulfill what Scripture said, that I have not lost any that has been given to me. I wouldn't be surprised if it was something like, yeah, it's me, run. Yeah, I'm Jesus of Nazareth, run. Yes, yeah, come and arrest me, get out of here. And that's why I think the disciples scattered. I don't think it was because they were chicken. I don't think it was because, I think they were told to. I can't prove that, but I give that to you. So they've run. Peter's following, though. So they led him to the house of the high priest, and we find out that there's six events that take place. He goes from Annas to Caiaphas, back to Annas, then he goes to Pilate, and then to Herod, and then back to Pilate. So there's all this movement that takes place. Luke only records just a little bit of it. And he records it right now. He's in the house of the high priest. And Peter is following. We find out from John that there is another disciple with him. There's two. Who's the other disciple? Well, that's what we think. Because John has a habit of saying, well, Peter and another disciple. You know, like when you call, you're like, I have this friend that really likes you. Yeah, you know, I'm really talking. It could possibly be John. I think there could be some evidence that it's not John, though. A couple of big things. One, how did they get access to the high priest's courtyard? How did they get let in? Hey, I say we all pack up. Let's go have a picnic. 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, right on the front lawn. Think we can pull it off? No! Now, if I called up Arnold, hey, Arnold, buddy, hey, yeah, I need to get in and have a picnic. He'd be like, no problem. I get you in, but I tax you first. No, yeah, I'm not going to. Sorry, that's political. Moving on. How did Peter and this other disciple get in? John doesn't wield any influence. Neither does Peter. In fact, Peter just chopped off Malchus's ear. We find out that Malchus goes and tells a friend because his friend is in the courtyard when Peter shows up. John's the one that records that. Kind of fascinating. So how did they get in? John couldn't. And another thing, when Peter's doing the whole denial thing, well, now I want to slap John around. Right? Let's say we're all sitting together and Jesus says one of you is going to betray me. And it's like, it's Josh, you are going to deny me three times, right? And then we go, you and me, and we go to this thing, and you say, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. I would go over, grab Josh, pull him aside, and say, what are you doing, you idiot? Jesus just said, slap him around a little bit. I would hold him accountable, right? I don't know if it's John. I wonder if it's Nicodemus. Oh, Cranky, you have an idea? It could be Simon the Zealot. It could be, what if it wasn't one of the 12? What if it was Nicodemus or Joseph of Arimathea? Now, these are people that would have no idea that there was this prophecy that took place of Peter denying Jesus. One other dumb idea, was it Judas? Has nothing to do with your eternal salvation, but I give it to you just for fun. I find it fascinating because I start to put this together going, wow, okay. Put it away. I know what you're all thinking about this. Peter denies Jesus. It goes something like this. Hey, do you know Jesus? Nope. Are you sure? I think you know Jesus. Nope. Are you sure? I think you really know Jesus. Nope. Cock-a-doodle-doo. Right? That's why we think it's, right? No, that's not how it is. Put that completely away. A lot of time happens in between every single thing. So the first one, it says, when they kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down, Peter sat down with them. A servant girl saw him seated close in the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, this man was with them. But he denied it. Woman, I don't know him. A little later, someone else saw him, said, "You also are one of them." "Man, I am not," Peter replied. About an hour later, so you're getting, this is not rapid fire succession. An hour later, another asserted, "Certainly this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean." John lays it out a whole lot cleaner, and we're indebted to him. It's really interesting because the first question that's asked to him, we can't do this in English except for our tone of voice, but we can't put it on a piece of paper. The first question that's asked him is constructed in a way in the Greek to anticipate a negative response. In the Greek, you can actually construct it that way. We can't do it really in English except through our tone of voice, right? I'm sitting there watching my youngest son reach into the cookie jar, grab a cookie, and he's eating, and he turns around, he looks at me, he's got crumbs all over his face, and I ask him the question, "You're not eating a cookie, are you?" And I'm anticipating him to say, "Yes, I am." That's my inflection gave this, anticipating a positive response. It was asked in such a way that it gave Peter an awesome out. This person doesn't think it anyway, so I'm just going to say no. It was an easy denial. It was a subtle denial. And you start thinking about that, and you wonder yourself, am I guilty of that? Subtle. Real easy. Have you ever kept silent in a situation where you should have spoken up? Have you ever led someone to believe that you're not a Christian? Not for the sake of opening up a discussion, but because you would be embarrassed by it. Has your words ever hurt someone so badly, and just in the action of you speaking, betrays that you follow Jesus Christ? Subtle, real small, not big, giant. Because I personally think if when that door opened up and Peter walks in and they're like, "It's you," you know, in this loud thing, I wouldn't be surprised if Peter would have grabbed his sword again or done something and stand. But that's how evil works. It's subtle. I don't know how many people could be tempted into committing an adulterous affair by having someone walk in completely buck naked saying, "Have sex with me." I don't think it works that way. Right? Because that one's really, he's like, "Whoa, no, whoa, hey, ah." Right? But that's not how it is. It's subtle. It starts small. Small denials. Small things. That's the sin of Peter. Not big, grandiose, flat-out denials. This is subtle. And you got to imagine, between the time of number one and number two, he's probably doing what we all do. Justifying what we just did. It wasn't really a lie, was it? Now, you know what? My desire is to be close to Jesus. My desire is to support Jesus. And the only way I could get into this courtyard is to lie. Yeah, no, I think God would be okay with that. It's okay if I deny just a little bit because it's for a greater good. And we start justifying that in our heads. Which is why when number two shows up and says you're with him, he's already talked himself into the first one was fine, so the number two comes out quite easily. And then that hour between number two and number three, he's probably doing the same thing. That's not bad, is it? It's not that big of a deal. And we start thinking to ourselves, the little things we do, I am one of the biggest culprits. Some of the little things I say and do betray that I should be a follower of Christ. And the trick is catching those and repenting of those, and trying better next time. I think that's why I've been much better in how I speak to other people. I've told you that story. It was probably one of my lowest of lows when I was talking with someone years and years and years ago about a loan refinance, and this dude was just giving me lie after lie after lie after lie, and so I finally, my loudest voice possible, said, "You know what? I hope you go to hell, and I'm a pastor, and I know exactly what that means." There's Jesus. Oh, sorry about that. Sorry. It's your head. And the worst part about it was I was using an office space where someone down the office, who was someone I was witnessing to and trying to bring to faith, heard everything I said. I betrayed. I denied that I knew God by my words. And you've got to ask yourself the question, do I do it? Not may not even be as bold and as great as what I've done. The little things. Little things where you deceive, or I don't want this person to know I'm a Bible-believing, church-going Christian. That would be bad. You do it to hide. It's not good. Verse 60, here's Peter's lowest of lows. Peter replied, "Man, I don't know what you're talking about." Just as he was speaking. So in the act of him saying this, the rooster crows. And verse 61 has got to be one of the weirdest, not weirdest, one of the most depressing verses in the Bible. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. I'm guessing that he's being shuffled again. So he's moving out. So he is now out in the courtyard. And you've got to imagine Peter as he is vehemently denying, because he's able to cross those other two denials pretty easily. And that third one, he is just coming right at it. And you've got to imagine that third one was asked, I believe that's the one that was asked by the friend of Malchus. So it's like, yeah, dude, I think it's you. You got a little blood spatter on your beard there, weren't you? I think you were with them. And as he denies it, just as he is doing it, the rooster crows, he looks over, and there is Jesus. I'm guessing he's either looking through a window or he's being escorted in that courtyard, and Jesus looks right at Peter. There's something about betraying a friend or denying a friend or doing some heinous sin, but then doing that right in front of that person makes it that much more horrible. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord spoken to him before the rooster crows. Today you will disown me three times. And he went outside and wept bitterly because he had known the depths of his sin. Judas does the same thing. He understands the depth of his sin, but what's the difference? One comes to God and one does not. One realizes that the depth of my sin can be given to God. One realizes that the depth of my sin can be forgiven. The other one realizes the depth of his sin and realizes there's no hope. There's no solution. There's no remedy. And you get to those points, and the question is, where are you going to go? Rich. It very well could be, because they didn't quite fully understand the resurrection, because where were they found 3 days after this? Hiding. So they were like, you know, if you truly believed that Jesus was coming back from the dead, you'd be like walking the streets, like, you know, where is he? He's got to be around here somewhere, they're hiding. So it very well could be that he looked at that. Church tradition has it, can't be proven, but church tradition has it that after that, every time Peter got up to speak, someone in the crowd would go, cock-a-doodle-doo. Can I ask you a question about your past sin? What does it do to you? Judas's past sins drive him to a point of absolutely no hope. Peter's absolutely colossal failure drive him like a laser beam to do great things for him. You may have gone down into the depths, but the thing is, there is restoration. And if you take a look back and go, I'm going to use every... You've got to imagine, I'm guessing that when Peter is giving his Pentecost preaching, 3,000 people come to faith that one day. Do you realize that Peter's past sin did not hold him back? And I would imagine that probably some people were heckling him. But Peter doesn't care. Yeah, I did all that. I messed up royally. But God has restored me. He's given me another chance, and now that's how I'm going to go forward. It's a radical difference between Judas and Peter. The guards mocked Jesus. The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, "Prophesy, who hit you?" This is illegal. This was not allowed. We've uncovered some of the rules of trials, especially capital trials, capital punishment trials. And this was absolutely forbidden, but it happened. And they're mocking Jesus. And that's why verse 63, and they said many other insulting things to him. Weak sauce! And they were also blaspheming other things. They weren't just saying prophesy to us, like, oh, you're God? Oh, yeah. Heal this. Oh, you're God? Well, then you knew I was just about to hit you. And that's the mocking that was happening was not just regular old, you're ugly and your mama dresses you funny. This is pure religious anger and hatred coming out. I could also do a whole case study on the different reactions of Jesus. The people that mock, the people that get injured, the people who are healed, the people that fall away, the people that follow. It's a rather interesting thing. So Jesus goes before Pilate here. At daybreak, the council, the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law met together, and Jesus was led before them. If you are the Christ, they said, tell us. Jesus answered, if I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I asked you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. And whenever you say you're seated at the right hand of the mighty God, and you talk about the Son of Man, you're in direct reference of Daniel chapter something about the Ancient of Days seated at the right hand of God who was actually God. And so he was saying, yeah, that's me. And they get it. They all asked, are you then the Son of God? He replied, you are right in saying I am. That blows anything out of the water of, Jesus never said he was God. Yeah, he did. Hundreds of times through his actions, but here's one as clear as you can get. Yep, you're right. Then they said to him, why do we need any more testimony? We've heard it from his own lips, which was illegal. Back in those days, much like today, you had the Fifth Amendment. But in those days, the Fifth Amendment was invoked on your behalf. That even if any testimony you gave could not be used against you in a court of law. And even if you're standing up there on the trial and you say something that damages you, it's automatically thrown out. You cannot be convicted on your own testimony. They had lots of rules, and some of those rules were great. You also couldn't kill anybody on a Passover, on a high feast. Also, if you were going to pronounce someone innocent of a capital crime, it could be issued that day. You could look at him and say, we don't find enough testimony. We don't believe this guy did it. He's free to go. But if you were going to convict him, you had to wait a mandatory 24 hours to impose that sentence. That was also illegal. They were also under some other constraints because they couldn't actually issue the death penalty. They had to take it to Pilate. They had to take it to the Romans too, because Romans had taken away the right of capital punishment. Lots of things going on here behind the scenes that once again realize that God is in control and the evil that is abounding, Jesus made no mistake about it. Darkness is reigning. That's what was happening at this time. Praise God, we know how it ends. And I pray for you that whether you were bloodied up by the church, or whether you have denied Christ like I have several times, that you stop and realize the depth of God's love for you. And you may be even resisting just as Judas did, and yet God still is offering out his gracious hand, saying, friend, come, be with me. That's his offer to you today. Gracious Father, thank you for your word and what it says and what it means. I pray for those, Lord, right now that have been hurt by Christians, for I know there are many. Some of them I know their stories, and some of them I don't know their stories. And I pray that you would heal them. I pray you would give us wisdom to know what to do with our swords, when to wield them, when to put them down, when to speak the truth in love and meekness and humility, and when to stay silent. Lord, help us, because we can only do this by your grace. And Lord, I fear that many of us have failed. Lord, I fear that all of us have failed, as we have denied you in so many ways, so many little things, way too numerous to count. And maybe we, like Peter, have said, no, I'll go to the death for you. I'd go to prison and die before I deny. And yet, we realize in our own depth of our sin, we can no longer do that either. So instead, Lord, even if we are daily reminded of our sin, even if we are constantly heckled because of the mistakes we've made, that we would still boldly stand up and proclaim your word, that we would boldly take this grace that you have given to us and use it for your kingdom and your power and your glory. Only you can do it. Leave us not, Lord, in that despair, and help us to see that as those arms were stretched on that cross, that you had said that you would draw all men to yourself. Draw us now to you. Help us see those nail-pierced hands and that wounded side and answer emphatically, that's love. That's love for me. In Jesus' name, amen.